Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In chapter 6 of his book, Language, Truth, and Logic, A.J. Ayer is going to set out what has come to be called an emotivist theory of ethics. And the version of it that A.J. Ayer has, he's treating it as a sort of meta-ethic, that is a higher level discourse that allows us to account for what's going on or what people think is going on in ethics and why it's not actually what it is that they think is going on. In a way, you could say that Ayer is trying to provide us with an analysis from a higher level that shows us why all of the people putting forth ethical theories and disagreeing with each other are not just in some respect wrong, but off base, that they're talking past each other and they're misunderstanding their subject. So emotivism claims to provide a view on ethical statements, theories, expressions, whatever it is that you want to say, anything that has to do with value in a moral sense, applying to our actions, our words. It claims to provide some sort of analysis of this that will show what's really going on. And for Ayer and for other emotivists, this has to do with our emotions or desires, preferences. He also uses the term moral sentiments at one point. So the things that we feel about ethics or about right and wrong, good and bad, all of those sorts of feelings that we have, that have come to us primarily through our upbringing and background, and perhaps through some education as well. Now, emotivism is not just a meta-ethics, sort of above the fray of ethics. It also does represent a more substantive view on ethics at a sort of bottom level, giving us some ideas about how we ought to approach things. So it's not totally meta-ethical, but Ayer's version of it remains primarily there. And we should begin by looking at this framework that he's setting out in this wonderful sentence. Before that, we should remind ourselves of what he's been doing in the rest of the chapter. So he's been examining other major theories of ethics and saying why it is that they don't do what they're supposed to be doing, looking at the distinction between fact and value, and examining how it is that we use language in ethical judgments, statements, propositions. So Ayer will go on and say that in every case, so this is unequivocally, this is categorically, in every case in which one would commonly be said to be making an ethical judgment of any sort, right? The function of the relevant ethical word is purely emotive. Notice he's not saying that the entire statement itself has a function that's purely emotive. There could be a lot of factual information which might be verifiable or might not. That could certainly be propositional in the other sense, able to be true or false. But the ethical component of it, the ethical word or words, its function, he's saying, is purely emotive. Now, what does it mean to have an emotive function? There's a number of different sub-functions entailed within what he's calling the emotive function. So going back to his own words, he says, it's used to express feeling about certain objects, but not to make any assertion of them. So what are we talking about? A little bit earlier, he says, in saying that a certain type of action is right or wrong, I'm not making any factual statement, not even a statement about my own state of mind. I'm merely expressing moral sentiments. And the man who's ostensibly contradicting me is merely expressing his moral sentiments. Neither of us is asserting a genuine proposition. So what are moral sentiments? Well, approval and disapproval are the ones that he, I think, takes to be most basic. But we could also talk about things like resentment or anger, you know, a sense that something has been violated and somebody ought to be punished or pay back for it. We might think about other moral sentiments like joy or sadness, when I approve of something, perhaps the approval that I am giving is because whatever I'm seeing or whatever is happening makes me feel happy to look at. You know, I see the proverbial Boy Scout helping the old lady cross the street, and I say, that's good. I really like that. That makes me feel, as my old philosophy instructor used to say, that gives me warm and fuzzy inside, right? As opposed to, that's bad, cold and prickly. I see the Boy Scout luring the old lady across the street and dropping her down an open manhole. Ooh, that's not good at all, right? What's going on there is an expression of my feeling. So Ayer says that one of the sort of sub-functions of this emotive function of the terminology that we're using there is to express our feelings or moral sentiments. And he says that this does not make an assertion. So this is worth dwelling on a little bit, because he also tells us that there is a tendency to view this language as if it is expressing our sentiments in such a way as to make an assertion, I am feeling this. This is what I feel towards that. So a little bit later, he says, I'm not really making any statement about my own feelings or about anything else. I'm only evincing my feelings, which is not the same as saying that I have them. The distinction between the expression of feeling and the assertion of feeling is complicated by the fact that the assertion that one has a certain feeling often accompanies the expression of that feeling and is then a factor in the expression of that feeling. So he uses the example of boredom to get this across. I may feel bored, right? And I can express that in a number of ways. Many of them are nonverbal. The silent language, to use the title of a book. Like, you know, I look around and I'm like, roll my eyes, big sighs, slouch a bit. Maybe somebody's talking and I'm doodling away and I'm like looking somewhere else. All of these are expressions of boredom, right? But I could also just say, I'm so bored, right? And in that case, he says, I can simultaneously express boredom and say that I'm bored. And in that case, my utterance of the words, I am bored, is one of the circumstances which make it true to say that I am expressing or evincing boredom. But I can express boredom without actually saying that I'm bored. I can express it by my tone and gestures while making a statement about something wholly unconnected with it, or by an ejaculation that is an emphatic expression, or without uttering any words at all. So Ayer is less interested in assertion. And why? Because an assertion would actually be something factual. If I say, I am feeling the feeling of boredom right now, or when I see the Boy Scout stealing the Girl Scouts cookies from the table where they're selling them, ooh, that makes me mad, or I deplore that, or, you know, anything along those lines, that's more assertion, right? I'm telling somebody how I feel. Instead, I can just express how I feel. I can say, Boy Scouts, bad, right? And in that case, I'm basically going, boo, I don't like that. I'm expressing my feeling. So that is what emotivists take much of our moral language, our moral judgments, the things that we share in this common space, either by writing or by speaking or in other ways, they take that to be at the essence of what we're doing. Simply expressing emotion, simply expressing how it is that we feel inside of ourselves, showing other people in some way what it is that we, in fact, approve of, disapprove of, other feelings that we have. There's one other major function to an emotivist theory of ethical language, and that is that ethical terms, as he says, also function to do two other things. They function to arouse feeling, and they function to stimulate action. Now, we might think of this primarily applying to other people, right? I see the Boy Scout sidling over to the Girl Scout table, and I can tell he's thinking about stealing the Girl Scout cookies, and I say to somebody else over there, stop him, right? That's a direct command. But I could also say things like, you know, let's say there's a long-term problem of Boy Scouts taking Girl Scouts cookies. I can write an op-ed piece and say, it is deplorable that Boy Scouts are stealing Girl Scouts cookies. What I'm saying there is, you should stop them. Or I'm not just saying, I don't like that. I'm also saying, you shouldn't like that either, right? And you can think about the ways in which we emphasize this and all the ways in which moral indoctrination really does work, you know, when we're bringing up children or trying to reformulate people's, you might call it, emotional moral manifold through training, we often say, this is good, this is bad, right? And even if we say it in a neutral tone of voice, what are we actually signaling to them? They should also view this as good, meaning they should have a positive emotional orientation towards it, and they should not do that sort of action. Why? Because that will be disapproved of, and perhaps if they come to internalize our own values, they come to feel and think of it in the same way. Likewise, when we say this is bad and you should not do it. So what's really going on linguistically then is that ethical language, the components of propositions that have ethical terms, are really just either expressions of our feeling, which may be accompanied by some sort of assertion but need not be, or they are disguised commands. They're not really propositions. They are imperative. They're saying, feel this, do this, don't feel this, don't do this. None of these are propositions, which means that none of them can actually be true or false. Now, you can go to a meta level and say, it is true that Dr. Sadler, in expressing this particular thing, was also giving me a command, but that's not saying that the command itself is true or false. You're now making a metalinguistic statement about a command that I gave to you. If I tell you, good students hand their papers in on time, what I'm doing is I'm expressing my own warm fuzzy towards certain kinds of students and certain kinds of behavior, and perhaps also, by implication, expressing cold pricklies, my disapproval of students who don't hand their things in on time. But I'm also saying, listen, buddy, hand your stuff in on time, right? I'm trying to give you some sort of a proverbial kick in the pants to get you to do something and to feel something. You should feel guilty for not getting your stuff in on time. Guilt is a moral emotion, right? So all of this hopefully illustrates what's going on. None of it is actually true or false. Now, whether you have an emotion or not, that is true or false. But that's an assertion. That's not an expression. And so, you know, we can step back and make all sorts of assertions, but that's not the emotive function of language. Now, what is the implication of this for ethics? Part of the implication would be that all of these people who think that ethics is really about moral facts or about describing the way things are in the world and not about values that we hold rather irrationally, we don't have good reasons to hold the values that we do. There is no possibility of rationally reconstructing what the best account would be or anything like that. We simply have them. That's it. That's all ethics can do. Ethics, Ayer will go on to say at another point, is largely a matter of psychology or sociology. The parts of it that actually do have to do with directly ethical terms, this is what's going on. It's only an expression of emotion, an attempt to induce emotion in others, or to produce some sort of action on their part, some conformity to what it is that we want. Moral disagreements also become rather intractable because we're not debating about something that another person could say is true or is false. So that becomes a significant problem as well. So if that's really the case, and if Ayer is right about this, there's a good portion of what we've traditionally looked at as ethics that becomes largely untenable, but it's replaced with this emotivist theory. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.